Nat Nichols, are you there?
Oh my gosh, Paul, we are not going to have any fun.
No fun at all?
No, it's been my policy for at least 15 years not to have any fun.
Oh man, okay. Well, I guess, you know, we will just have to just and ah our way through this segment and curtail any fun or laughter. Oh God, I ummed. Hey, are you on speakerphone by chance?
I'm not, but I'm using my headphones, which is a new thing for me. I can turn those off.
Yeah, well, let's see. It sounds okay. It doesn't sound terrible. I've heard a lot worse, but just wanted to make sure.
People said that to me before.
That's so much judgment. So much judgment. No, but actually, you know what I realized? It's probably my volume in the headphones that I need to turn up. Everything is a technical issue today. And that's what life is about, are these little issues that you don't usually hear talked about on the radio unless you're listening to Toss Salad or Filter, where we always make the sausage live.
I was going to say, Paul, that I've been on Toss Salad, God, I don't even know how many times. And it was definitely in the era of being able to breathe at each other's faces. Mm. And it's a very different jam doing this in front of my cat.
Yes, your cat. I just think of me as your cat.
You guys have some similar characteristics. I can see it.
What's your cat's name?
Sherpa.
Sherpa. Well, I, in a past life, carried a lot of heavy things. Maybe. Maybe not. Well,
maybe.
Let's
maybe.
So for Toss Salad listeners, you may remember Nat Nichols as many different things, but currently of note, editorial cartoonist recently for The Leader. But are you still doing it for The Leader?
I am. I've actually been doing it for 2 years.
2 years now? Oh, God. It's like the last year was just contracted
it was a
upon
do-over.
Itself.
We
yeah.
Just forget about it. You know, I was realizing, Paul, that I met you when I had my 33 1/3 birthday party in your bar, which was a hot minute and a half ago. So
I remember.
Wait a minute, yeah.
And I remember the first time I really talked to you was outside of when The Broken Spoke caught on fire. Or maybe it wasn't The Broken Spoke then. Maybe it was The Record Store. But that building caught on fire, and we watched it burn and kind of met each other there.
You know, I've always met the very best people at fires.
It's true. I mean, burning, the fire is a symbol of good understanding and bonds for life. maybe not. I don't know. But Nat and I did a cartoon play based on a conversation that she and I had a few years back, so it would be like 2 years back, maybe, in the Uptown, and talking about housing as well. And this, maybe you could talk a little bit about how you developed this form, what it is. I mean, it's pretty amazing that you are able to translate these themes, these local themes, into cartoons that are both funny, but also really at times very somber. But they always have like cute little animals in it to kind of make the blows not softened, but sort of make it more palatable, I guess. It's always very well done. And I always look forward to seeing the latest one. And it sounds like, you may be producing one based on our conversation today.
That's the plan. Yeah. I started doing this a couple years ago after I put out a book about the race to Alaska. And it's been kind of my dream to be able to tell real stories. I never really thought that I'd be telling real stories every week in a newspaper in three panels, which is like it's the sad downfall of my life is trying to constantly turn everything interesting and beautiful and cool that the people I talk to and interview and the things I think about into three panels. But it's kind of a fun things that have to do where you are breaking up large blocks of text and really complicated ideas. And you mentioned the animals, and the animals came about because I realized, I think maybe even 6 months into the comics, that was a while, that anytime you put a human on something, you're showing your own prejudices and your own and you're showing other people's prejudices, and you're allowing people to read things into it. So if I'm going to do something like talk about the homeless, then I would, or rather I talk about the unhoused, I would much rather have raccoons talking about it or doing something about it than have somebody with a gender and with a ethnicity and with a sex be talking and doing something about such a complicated issue. Let's go ahead and we'll take all of our preconceived ideas out of it, and we're just going to put them all on raccoons and let the raccoons deal with it.
Mm. And so do the animals have different characterizations for you? Like, because sometimes you use crows. I think it's crows and raccoons are the most notable ones that I can think of having a conversation in your comics. Is that accurate?
Yeah, each animal has its own subject. So let's see, I use the crows for when I talk about Squim, and I am using raccoons for talking about the unhoused, and oh gosh, I can't remember off the top of my head what I do with everybody else, but there's always like an animal that's a particular thing. I just started using my cat Sherpa to talk about police budget reform.
Perfect. I mean,
it's because he doesn't care about anything. He's just like so disappointed in everything. And I'm just like, I'm going to channel that energy, Sherpa, and I'm going to put it directly into police reform.
So you're going to, in some ways, capture Sherpa's indifference and make Sherpa care about things more than Sherpa already does.
Yeah, I often do that with my animals. I'll have one animal who cares very deeply about something trying to explain to an animal who like really doesn't care why they should care.
So are we going to be animals today?
Oh my gosh, maybe.
Okay. Maybe you can have
an animal you'd like to be.
I don't really, I used to think that like dogs were my spirit animal or whatever. That's a little bit un-PC to say, but like dogs were like the animal that I most corresponded to. But I don't feel like a dog. Maybe I am a dog. I don't know. So I guess dogs is like my first thought. And then what would I like to be or what I want to be would absolutely be a flamingo.
You know, I really enjoy drawing birds, and I've never drawn a flamingo, so this could be your day.
Awesome. So, well, I'm not going to try and govern the comic or see where it goes, but maybe I did. Maybe I just, you know, just planting seeds. We should actually, let's kick it off because we got about, 30, 40 minutes to talk about this, and it might be an issue that goes on. So, What did maybe you ask the question, because I kind of know the question, but maybe rephrase sort of the general topic of what you want to talk about today and how you want this comic to. What are we creating?
No problem. So most of my comics are created from interviews. So I'll take over from here on the interviewing the radio host front.
Thank God.
The thing about affordable housing is extremely complicated, very difficult to understand, and I'm looking everywhere I can to figure out what things we can do to try to make it better. And as you probably know, Paul, my boyfriend and I, well, I say and I as though I have any money, my boyfriend is buying a house that I will live in. And so I was thinking about the process of it and thinking about how much control from a buyer's perspective real estate agents have, and was wondering why there isn't a bigger push for real estate agents to counteract this gigantic housing boom that's happening for second homes and helping to protect our community better. And I'd like to hear what you think about that. I've talked to some other agents also about how powerless they feel, but how do you personally feel about being a part of the housing boom?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, right? Because I don't see, if you define a housing boom, it would be like, my first instinct is like, well, there's a lot of housing being produced, and because there's a lot of buyers.
Opposite. Yeah, that's the problem. It's the opposite. is that there's no housing being produced.
Right. Yeah. So the boom is in prices because of lack of availability, and so it's the sheer number of buyers. You know, there are so many people looking to buy, and so few opportunities for them to find houses. And that was really reflected this year. We had record land sales. I'd have to like pull up the records from me, but I think Jefferson County had never, at least in the last 10 years, experienced such a high volume of land sales. And that's raw land in Jefferson County in total. And, you know, listings that had sat for, you know, some for 10 years were finally being sold because all these folks with money coming through, they weren't being able to find their house, you know, situations. So they opted to buy and build on land that is going to be somewhat difficult and expensive infrastructure wise to create habitats on.
And especially right now with the fact that it's so expensive to build anything at the moment.
It's expensive from two perspectives, right? So it's expensive from, you know, Corona has definitely driven up labor prices and materials prices. I mean, the cost of new roofs has gone up, I think, in the realm of like just $5,000 to $10,000 for materials alone during the pandemic. And there's also labor as well. And then the other thing, especially when you're looking in building in Port Townsend, which has very old plat maps that were kind of creating all these different lots that weren't anywhere near infrastructure, and infrastructure wasn't being developed and pushed towards these lots as they're being sold. And the city has no money to actually do most of these infrastructure projects. Like occasionally the city has done projects like the Rainier Street sub area where they installed water and sewer into these streets and created streets to encourage people to develop commercial business, you know, or rental buildings or apartment buildings in these areas. And that's actually working now. But in general, for lots that, you know, people look at around Port Townsend, they're going to spend a pretty penny. I mean, I always tell people think $40,000 for some of these lots that aren't close to infrastructure, $40,000 to $50,000 just to make it buildable. And that doesn't even necessarily include a foundation. So this lack of housing that was available, the lack of inventory, really pushed our land sales just exponentially high. October, let's see. I wish I could show people on the radio these stats, but closed sales for land alone in December of 2020, 314 lots, or, you know, collections of lots, basically 314 sales of raw land of varying sizes and prices in December of 2020. Compare that to December of 2019, and it's 209. The highest number of land sales previously before December of 2020 was October 2018, 245. So nowhere near that level. It's an absolute paradigm shift in terms of land sales, and has, you know, obviously made land cost more and be more competitive. And, you know, for January, it was there were 314 closings for land. So it really is kind of, it's up there and it's staying up there. And at some point, we're going to run out of land inventory because of it.
And we already have very, very low house inventory. So once again, this is slightly anecdotal evidence on my behalf because I'm not dealing with raw data in the same way that you are, but a house that we were looking at that our agent told us had a murder bathroom, and it went for $100,000 over asking price in cash because it's just nothing.
Yeah.
But the real thing about this is, like, what role can the people who are making money off of sales have in this? And I know from talking to the people that it's not a lot. But looking at mortgage brokers, appraisers, and realtors, what can you guys do? Is there anything you can do to help fix the housing crisis here?
Well, I think there's always things in terms of how you support the community and how you support people as an individual beyond what you do. Just wanted to say that first of all, as I go in to talk about what it means to be a realtor in my mind. And the truth is, like, most of the realtors I'm around, even the pros who've been doing this 20 plus years and make a really, really, you know, decent living doing it, is, and decent's obviously being a, that make a lot of money doing it. They are all slow. They are all not working very much. This market is good if you have good connections, you know, and you get the right listings, you have buyers that are super powerful in terms of having, you know, lots of money and ability to compete. But there's a lot of other realtors who are just not working nearly as much as they would normally because there is just no inventory. So I don't think, like, there are some realtors that if they're getting lucky, then maybe they're celebrating and they're like, hey, yeah, I'm really benefiting off of this. But I don't like seeing prices this high. I mean, they're not realistic. And I'd say half my clients are first time home buyers. Like, I would love to be working more, you know, and I'm truly, it's like you have, I have a fair amount of buyers, but I don't have anything to sell them. And that's obviously ultimately makes it more difficult for everyone to find housing. It hurts the rental market because, people with rental houses are like, oh, I better take advantage of this, you know, frenzy and sell now, in case the market crashes. And then people are asked out of their rentals because of that. And it's not conducive to, I think, what it means to be a real estate agent to me to, you know, be stuck in this place where it's like, yeah, if I have a sale, I'm going to make a, you know, a fair amount of money, maybe more than I would in a different market. But if I'm just not able to help buyers find things, you know, and if I was more of a listing agent, if I'm not able to, like, actually do the work that I'm used to doing, we don't actually have tenable careers, you know. And the crash of 2008, the Great Recession, I wasn't a real estate agent back then, but I hear the stories of how many realtors, you know, lost, basically couldn't continue, had to find different jobs, had to go into different worlds. So in terms of what realtors can do, one of the myths I think people have is that realtors are really in charge of what things cost. That we say, oh, I'm going to set this price and maybe we'll get it. And, you know, we'll shoot high and then see, you know, if I can really just get more money out of it. But what we do in those cases where we're helping people price things is we look at, you know, the last 180 days or so of what sold. And we, you know, kind of determine how connected those sales are, call them comparables, to whatever we're trying to price. And when we do that, we are, you know, we're actually under a legal obligation based on being a realtor and being a licensed agent, is that we are going to do our best to honestly represent what we believe is the right price. And there's, believe it or not, we have a code of ethics, which I do my best to adhere to when I can remember what the code is. But
throne of life. All right.
I swear I'm ethical.
Oh my gosh.
I can already see this comic. So this is just to say that, you know, folks say, oh man, this realtor totally, you know, drove up the price here and, you know, really is just like gatekeeping people from buying these things because of the price. And it's like, nah, it's actually really an interaction with the seller, you know. And I've seen it, and we've all seen it, and I'm not afraid to say it, that there are folks who, you know, will talk about being for affordable housing and will bemoan the state of real estate in our city, in our county. And then when they go sell their house, they ask you and they want what's the most I can get for my house. So when it comes to people's own money, even beyond like what they state in terms of their ethics, not everyone, in fact, most people will not make a choice to sell for less. He will not make a choice.
No, I totally understand that. And it's one of those things where it's like, so I have a really big conversation with Kate Dean, who is one of the county commissioners, about this. I was like, you know, I was like, Kate, you know, tell me in, 10 words or less how to fix the housing crisis. And just, you know, uninterrupted laughter. But basically, I keep wanting, because I'm a socialist and because I spent most of my adult life in a socialist country, I want the government to fix it. Like, that is who I am and where I am from. I'm like, there is a problem. If this is what's happening, it's a problem with regulations, it's a problem with government spending, there's a problem, and the government just needs to work out how to fix it. And what I keep hearing from my progressive friends here in Washington State is that what we actually are going to have to do to be able to solve this is to have individual people decide to sell their homes to their friends and sell, rent out spare rooms, and it's going to be down to individual people and philanthropists. Mm. And nothing infuriates me more than to hear that. I get that that's actually, you know, some of this is taking personal responsibility in your life and for the way that the situations are. And that I can completely get behind. But the fact that there's not a bigger picture way to deal with this beyond the, we have to find a way to build more housing, we have to find a way to get the state to offer a more tax credit so that we can have more affordable housing, is really frustrating.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I see solutions for everything. I could fix all the world's problems, but the thing is there are these big battles, right? And of course, I know Stalin said he could fix all the world's problems, and I get that idea. But
he did, didn't he?
Right? Yeah, we're all great now. It's all, yeah.
Thanks, Stalin.
Thank you, Stalin. Just kidding. all opinions expressed here are my own and Nat's, not KPTZ's. But seriously.
Yeah. Happy anyone.
Yeah. We're sorry about the Stalin comment already. So right, just straight off the bat, if we're going to look specifically at Washington, then amend our constitution to allow for an income tax up to like 10.5%. I think if we had a 10.5% income tax, we could abolish literally all other taxes in Washington state and still make more money and have more money for subsidies, like in the millions and millions, the tens of millions more than we currently earn based on our regressive tax structure. So
I mean, but then what would Jeff Bezos do?
Right, I know, he'd go somewhere else, and obviously we would miss out on all that tax income that we're not really getting anyways, and that the projects.
Oh my God. I have to say, if you're a human being and you're listening to this and you buy things off of Amazon, Just stop. Don't give the man any money. Please, for the love of God, don't give the man any money.
I mean, living out in small town rural areas, I think that Amazon happens. You know, Amazon happens out here.
You know, it happens because you've decided that's the easiest thing that can happen. I don't buy anything off of Amazon. I've gotten lots of lovely handwritten notes from people. Something you may not know about me, Paul, is that I'm a massive board game fanatic.
Oh, I didn't know that.
All of my board games from a place that does trades and secondhand, and they're delightful. You know, there's just a lot of ways you can get around doing that if that's what you realize you can't do anymore. If you take the option off the table, it's really easy to live without it.
All right, well, we should do a whole episode about Nats, how to cut the Amazon cord.
You just do it. A friend of ours, Andrew Shaw, was talking to me about Facebook, and I was like, I would totally leave Facebook tomorrow, but it's just so hard. He's like, why don't you just do it? And so I was just like, I just like logged out right then, and I didn't come back for 6 months. I was like, okay, cool. Yeah, you're right.
Oh yeah, it's totally enjoyable to take those breaks too, because like at first you're like, I'm missing out, but then you're like, I don't even care. Like
I don't need the stress.
When I quit, it's usually I have this moment where I scan my feed and I'm like, I don't care about any of this. I don't care. Why is this getting my time? I don't care. I mean, like, I love my friends, but I don't care. Okay, time to leave.
I gotta get you back on with, so yeah, you're right, income tax. The state needs an income tax so that we could actually start funding affordable housing projects in a real way.
And I don't mean to put that forward as a way to say, like, oh yeah, throw away the responsibility, throw it into somebody else's hands. But I mean, really, at the end of the day, like, it is these kinds of solutions. It's just like, in my mind, we won't solve the opioid epidemic without decriminalizing all hard drugs, you know, which is something that's starting to happen.
This comes down to, what do I pay my government for? And I pay them more than enough money. I pay my government to make sure that there's clean drinking water, and that people are taken care of. That's what I pay my government for. And if they're not doing that, then they're not doing their job.
Right. Yeah, I agree. But if also we don't have mechanisms to properly pay the government, and we have created a culture in our country where paying the government actually is like a negative thing, a bad thing, then, you know, folks like Bezos, folks like Gates, of course, there are certain ways they're funding governments, but not in the scope of how they would be if they actually fairly paid their taxes. But these folks believe that they're above government. I mean, they see governments as being smaller than them, you know, lesser than them.
True, and this is part of my argument against philanthropy. I don't really want philanthropy. I want people to be charged taxes in a way that means that the people decide where the money goes, not where the wealthy person decides where the money goes.
Yeah, I am completely behind that, and I do think that it's sad thinking about like all the things that I would love to see happen in Port Townsend and realizing that many of them need somebody with just extremely excess cash to come in and say, I'm just doing this at a loss. You know, I'm doing this because I won the lottery and now I'm going to fund this stuff because this town is important to me, because this place is important to me. And that's
it hurts my soul that's a solution that I hear people talk about, is that we'll just get somebody who's wealthy to come in and help solve affordable housing.
But it's not a solution either, because it's like saying, I'm just going to go be a triple platinum recording artist. You know, like it's completely based on luck and not based on any kind of actual like work. You know, you can't move a ball forward to get the billionaire to come here and build a bunch of apartment complexes in the Rainier Street area.
So Paul, you and I are the older side of millennials. You know, we believe that you can become anything you want to become, right?
When Trump became president, I realized that anyone could in fact become president, and that was not a good thing anymore.
Anyone
can become a billionaire if they really want to become a billionaire. That is, but all billionaires should be reduced to 500 millionaires. For me, if you believe somebody has a right to $1 billion, I will never agree with you on that point. I will never, ever agree with you on this point. I mean, I can't, I almost set like the 500 million as just because I don't understand what it's like to have that much money. And it seems like with 500 million, you could do a lot of good with that money. You could also live, you know, the level of comfort that you're accustomed to. And you're going to have the best life possible. You're going to be winning in every possible way. How could you need more than that? More than you would never spend? Like, why would you want that? And is it really immoral of a government to say you can have as much money as you want? Like, is that an immoral stance? Is that a wrong stance? Or is it actually immoral to have that much money and to not, you know?
Think that people who are willing to bet billionaires don't actually know what $1 billion looks like. And frankly, I do not know what $1 billion looks like. I cannot fathom having that much money. Hell, I can't even fathom how to pay my bills most months. Like, the idea that I would have that much more money than what I needed is beyond. And I get that when people say that they like the idea of millionaires and billionaires, it's because they like the idea of being able to achieve that. But that is not, you're also saying that you want somebody to have more resources than you in a very big way.
Yeah. Well,
it's just, yeah.
We're relating back to realtors and what realtors can do in terms of helping with this crisis. there are things that realtors can do in terms of educating their buyers and sellers to really understand that it's a crisis, and that if they're making certain decisions, that they're making them in light of the social impacts of those decisions. And that's hard, I think, for some realtors to really break that news to their clients, and depending on the politics of their clients, right? And so much of the realtor relationship with clients is something like a therapist, you know, that in many ways, there are certain realtors I can think of who would tell somebody that you know, they were doing this the wrong way, or they were making a bad decision. But I think there's a lot of realtors that would not, you know, and that would just sort of ride along with it, because what they're there is chaperoning, you know, the paper experience through. And so much of being a realtor really is just listening to somebody while they're going through something difficult, and helping chaperone the paper trail so that everything ends up happening the way it needs to actually, you know, close the sale. And fundamentally, and you know, when you mentioned what this you wanted to talk about, like the first thing I thought of was what I was mentioning earlier, was that people imagine that realtors set these prices. And I think that it's that when you haven't actually done the job, you believe that because you're like, oh, I'm just seeing what I can get for this house. But really, at the end of the day, that's a relationship between the sellers and the realtors that we will list for whatever we're told to list for. And we also will provide, you know, values that are connected to what is happening in the market. So in some ways, we're just journaling for the sellers what's possible. And the choices they make often are based around how much money can I get? What's the most money I can get for something? And I think that that's a misconception about realtors. I also think that, you know, a lot of it is just like, oh, you know, we're kind of just leeches hanging on to the process. You were just trying to get paid for all these different things. And I've had to struggle with that one a little bit. You know, when I started, I was like, what is my role? You know, and how am I of value in this? You know, what ways am I earning my commission? And a lot of that has, you know, personally for me, and I would hope other realtors would be able to find this as well, and I know many have, is finding a way to give back with the money that they make, you know. And if you have a really great transaction and you know, get a big commission check, finding ways to reinvest that money into your community, I mean, is just essential. You know, it's absolutely essential, and it can be any form that you want. But I mean, personally, what I try and do is, you know, turn that money to GoFundMes, you know, private donations, you know, pay attention to what's happening in your community and support things and entities, not even necessarily nonprofits, but support human beings, you know, support your friends who are struggling. Make sure, you know, that you can support them in times where they're in crisis, but also, you know, buy them something nice, you know, just out of the blue. If you have the ability to do this. And to be fair, like, that's not all realtors either. There are actually many realtors who are struggling through this. And I think that sometimes, you know, you realize people end up as realtors. The best people who I think end up being realtors are people who really care about people and want people to have a good experience and want to, you know, look at housing as something from, you know, all points, and not just showing a house or writing a contract, but the whole spectrum of housing in the place where you live. And I know nothing about real estate in, you know, urban areas, absolutely nothing. I only know rural real estate. And I think to myself all the time, I'm like, there's no way I'd want to do real estate if it wasn't in a rural area. You know, it means so much more. The connections are so much more important, and it's just more exciting.
I can completely understand that. You know, you were asking more about what I do with comics, and I cannot imagine moving to National Comics at this point. I've ended up with a really good freelance space telling rural stories, and I cannot imagine doing one panel comics about the president ever. It just wouldn't be satisfying for me to be able to do this. I like I really enjoy being able to look at the microcosm of where we live and being able to explain what it's like to be in a small rural area that has small rural problems. It's, you know, it feels very personal being here, and I can imagine that being a real estate agent and knowing the buyers and the sellers and having a good idea, you know, it's been a really funny thing being something of a public figure in a small town and trying to buy a house and knowing that I'll probably know both real estate agents and the seller and et cetera. It's just, there's something really delightful about feeling like you're a part of a community.
Absolutely. That's why we do it. So let's take a little, we're getting close to wrapping up. Let's take a musical break and then talk to Nat a little bit more and kind of finalize the comic before we have to run out of here at 3. Nat, do you want to introduce the song you brought?
Oh, yeah. Defiance, Ohio, Susquehanna, which I'm probably pronouncing wrong. They pronounce it really long because they sing it as Susquehanna, but it makes me feel ridiculous to say it with that many syllables. But yeah, that's, you know, 90s, 2000s punk DIY kid is pretty much who I am.
Well, let's get into it.
I'm almost 40.
You revealed it. Okay, here we go. Oh, Susquehanna. Oh my God, I'm not going to say it. Here we go. Defiance, Ohio, and then we'll finish up with Nat and send you on your way. You're listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM. This is Filter. I'm Paul Rice. That's Nat Nichols. This is Defiance, Ohio. You're back on Filter. Tail end. This is KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. Nat Nichols. Still there?
Hi. I'm still here.
Are you done with your cartoon yet?
Oh, God.
Just kidding. Just kidding.
Didn't know I was drawing live.
That'll be next time. Yeah, next time we'll make you do it in studio. We'll do a traditional Phil Andrus 4-hour Iron Man filter, and you'll just have to draw the whole cartoon during filter.
Oh, my God, that'd be really fun just to sit in the corner and write a comic and have it done by the end.
Yeah, and just we occasionally harass you and harangue you and be like, are you done yet? good times.
You are my cat, Paul. I had no idea.
I am Sherpa. I'm Sherpa in human form. Well,
just like, are you done yet? Are you done yet? Do you want to pet my belly?
Oh, Sherpa. That actually does sound like me. That sounds like me. So, yeah. There I am. Who knew I was a cat in another life or in this life? I didn't know that. So we are finishing up our conversation. Do you have any other questions? Did we like actually get anything useful out of this conversation? Do you see a comic in this? Do you have any other questions or things you want to get at?
I have a really big question, and you're going to hate me for asking a really big question right at the end.
Maybe not.
But it's not from me. It's one of my followers on Instagram reached out and had a big question. And I feel like I understand local government well enough to have my own opinions on this, but I want to hear your opinion.
Yeah.
Which is, should real estate agents be involved with the government? Should they hold government offices?
Oh, yeah.
Or does their standing, them standing to benefit financially pose an issue?
Well, so... First of all, I will say that I have a government position. I'm an appointed member of the Planning Commission and was the chair for a couple of years, and that's since 2015, so about 6 years. Well, it'll be 6 years in the fall. And, you know, Planning Commissions do deal with certain elements in terms of building regulations, things like that, zoning issues, although the Port Townsend Planning Commission doesn't deal specifically with big changes, and actually we can't hold hearings or anything like that. What we are is a resource for city council to be able to ask us to research things and come up with the best ideas. And it's definitely taught me a lot about real estate and helped me understand what was happening in terms of city government as it relates to development. And I would just say that, like, you know, if there's any conflict of interest, I'm beholden to announce it, you know, when I'm involved in something that could be connected, and I never have been this whole time, you know, made money off of anything having to do with real estate and my planning commission appointment. And also will say that, like, all those meetings, I mean, they're just entirely, they're all available online. They're all you know, stuff. And I feel like most of my work on Planning Commission has been involved in working to create more housing, you know, and working with the Housing Task Force to reduce some of these issues and assist with issues, and also help, you know, create, you know, very permissive laws for homeless encampments or unhoused encampments and the like. So this is a long-winded way of saying I believe that it is too bad that being in a position like say on city council or, you know, in the Planning Commission, a lot of times it means, since it's unpaid or very, very limited payment, you know, folks who are on these positions usually are going to have jobs that allow them to have the spare time to do it. Right.
Right. I mean, so it's either people who are going to have a job that has some flexibility, like being a real estate agent, or it's people who don't need money, which, you know, frankly, I don't know if I want to have people who don't need money representing my interest.
Right. But then the other side of that is, how do you pay a living, you know, wage to folks, you know, by a city that truly does not have the money, you know, that absolutely right. doesn't, I mean, that would be very difficult and certainly would rob Peter to actually pay living wages to city council members. And it's a tough one. I know I had Michelle Sandoval on here a few weeks ago, and who is obviously been the target many times of ire for being so involved in city government and also a real estate broker, you know, she's fully in favor of making it a paid position and really encouraging folks from the community to step up who aren't just, you know, independently wealthy or, you know, have a very, very gainfully employed, to be able to help run the city and make decisions. And I think that people are in favor of it. So really, but getting back to the crux of the question, you know, I've been accused many times of being, you know, a shill and somebody who is, you know, basically only involved in city government in order to make money. Let alone the fact that I was, involved in city government running for office and learning about it before I was actually a realtor, that, you know, is notwithstanding, I have not ever in my time had the chance to enrich myself because of that. And it's something that I've always done because I feel like I care about Port Townsend and I want it to be a better place. And I you know, believe the same about Michelle specifically, because I think that's sort of where the question points out. And I think that both Michelle and I
do want to clarify that I don't feel like that about Michelle. And when I brought Michelle up to the person who asked me the question, they also were like, that wasn't who I was talking about.
Oh, really?
I didn't push them to find out who they were.
Okay. Then yeah. So I that's just my assumption, because I've seen it so many times. You know, I've just seen it so many times.
Yeah.
And the truth is, like, there is there's always the possibility of impropriety, but. But I do believe that realtors can be ethical members of city government and also do their job in a way where they're not being enriched by it.
I feel like people who, there's a checks and balances with city government that, in general, I feel like isn't that easy to understand, the relationship between the city manager and the city council. And, you know, up until maybe 2 months ago, I felt like that was a balance that was made sense. It was good and interesting and helped keep things above board. But, you know, then everything that happened at SQIM in the past couple of months has made me realize that it's actually not impossible to circumvent what feels like reasonable checks and balances in local government.
Yeah.
So,
hey,
now I'm open to anything.
Well, we got to cut it off. Thank you so much for talking to me, and we'll see you again hopefully soon.
Yeah, hopefully maybe in real life someday, Paul.
Would love it. Bye.